What makes for a great vacation? Depends on who you ask. Are you looking to get away? Or bring everyone together? Do you want to get outside and play? Or see a play at the plate? Fortunately, however you operate, I'm the destination you've been looking for. The name's Missouri, but you can call me Mo. And I have just one question. What's your MO? Come see me at visitmo.com.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
From April 1971 to September 1972, 60 young black girls, all around the same age, were abducted from their own neighborhoods and then murdered in Washington, D.C. All of their bodies were found either in the District of Columbia or Prince George's County, Maryland. Despite there being six victims, an obvious serial killer, and all of the girls being identified, these murders have still gone unsolved. So to this day, the media has dubbed this unknown serial killer as the Freeway Phantom. And in hopes of raising awareness, sparking interest, and honoring the victims, I'm going to tell the story of the Freeway Phantom murders today. Now I want to note before I start that I'll be referring to the victim's race in this story as black. That's because I'm not able to find out or ask if they're African American, and I know that black and African American are not always interchangeable. So as a default, I will be using black to describe their race. Our case begins on April 21st, 1971. Carol Denise Spinks lived at 1058 Wheeler Place and was in the 7th grade at Johnson Junior High School. She was actually one of 8 children, and her siblings all called her Babe instead of Carol. In a 2019 article by People Magazine, Carol's sisters, Carolyn Morris and Vander Spinks, remembered that young Carol loved to play jacks and hula hoop. She was just very fun to be around. That night, April 21st, 1971, Carol's mother, Lantine, decided to visit an aunt in Brentwood, Maryland, which left Carol and her younger siblings home alone for the night. They were strictly instructed to stay inside the home and absolutely go nowhere while their mom was out. Carol's 24-year-old sister, Valerie, actually lived in the same apartment complex as the family, just in a different apartment because she was older and living independently. So there were adults nearby, a sister right next door if the kids ever needed help. But despite the rules, after Lantine left, sources say that Carol was asked by her older sister Valerie to walk down to the 7-Eleven on Wheeler Road to buy some snacks for the night. The 7-Eleven was only 4 blocks away, and they had made this walk many times before. They actually wanted 5 TV dinners, some bread, and some soda. So Carol decided to quickly begin the trek to the 7-Eleven, and according to the case file episode on this case, she actually ran into her mother on the way to the 7-Eleven, the same mother who had just told her not to leave the house. When Carol explained what she was doing and that her older sister Valerie had sent her, Ellentine told her, "Okay, hurry along and go grab this stuff, but you are still in trouble, and go home after and do not leave the house until I'm back." Ellentine said goodbye to her daughter and continued on with her night as Carol continued on her journey to the gas station. I mean, I was thinking about it. It's a 6-minute walk, 4 blocks away. That's not far at all. But as time passed and Carol was taking longer and longer, again, we're talking 4 blocks. Valerie, the older sister, began to worry. Then slowly, it had been 3 painful hours since Carol had originally left for the 7-Eleven, and she still hadn't come home. By this point, Valerie had alerted friends and family, and everyone in the complex began searching for her, tracking the way to the 7-Eleven and back home. The family even contacted 7-Eleven and asked if Carol had been there. The employees informed them that yes, they had seen a girl matching Carol's description in the store earlier that night, around 7:40 p.m. That confirmed to her family that she had, in fact, made it to the 7-Eleven after running into her mom. So what happened on her way home? Where was she? There was no sign of Carol on the route to 7-Eleven, and she had now been missing for hours. Alentin decided to call the police and report Carol missing. As police began the investigation into Carol's disappearance, they discovered that the last time she had been seen was leaving 7-Eleven that night with grocery bags in her hands. It was actually a teenager and her mother who noticed Carol walking back home, and they told police. Around 40 members of the community and the whole Spinks family continued searching the surrounding area for days, knocking on anyone and everyone's door. But still, there was no sign or clue as to where young Carol was. As the search continued, something was discovered. On May 1st, 1971, 10 days after Carol went missing, around 2:46 p.m., a group of children were playing near a grassy embankment behind St. Elizabeth's Hospital, located next to the northbound lanes of Interstate 295. The embankment was about a mile and a half away from Carol's home, so not far at all. One of the children wandered away from the group and accidentally stumbled across something lying in the embankment. The young child called over their friends, but no one would get close enough to see what it actually was. They all ran back up to the road and eventually flagged down a passing police car to tell them about the strange thing laying down in the embankment. Policeman made his way down to the area and confirmed his worst fears. It was the body of a young girl, the body of missing Carol Spinks.
What makes for a great vacation? Depends on who you ask. Are you looking to get away or bring everyone together? Do you want to get outside and play or see a play at the plate? Fortunately, however you operate, I'm the destination you've been looking for. The name's Missouri, but you can call me Mo. And I have just one question. What's your MO? Come see me at visitmo.com.
Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker.
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%. Vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
Carol had been strangled and sexually assaulted. She had cuts on her face, neck, chest, and both hands, as well as a bloody nose. He was definitely beaten. Police actually found green synthetic fibers on Carol's clothing. While she was completely dressed when she was found, she was missing the blue tennis shoes she'd been wearing when she went missing. So, she was dressed head to toe, just no shoes. I was thinking about it too, because she went missing with groceries in her hand. Did he take the groceries too? I mean, it just seems like to take everything would be hard, right? Like, how many bags did she have? Did he have to go back for them? There's just so many scenarios running through my head. Carol was still wearing the same gym shorts and red sweater she had left the house in 10 days earlier. Based on the position her body was found in, police theorized that she was either thrown down into the embankment from the freeway or dragged there. They didn't think she had been carried, and just imagining that someone threw her body out of a car and it rolled down into the embankment is really disturbing. An autopsy determined that she had only been dead for 2 to 3 days, when it had been 10 days since she went missing. That suggested she had been alive since the night she disappeared. There was citrus fruit found in Carol's stomach contents, but her family confirmed they didn't have any citrus fruit at home, and Carol hadn't eaten any that day before going missing. All this confirmed that Carol didn't just go missing that night. She was abducted, kidnapped, beaten, abused, and murdered, then dumped so carelessly just a mile and a half away from her home. It was cruel, evil, and incomprehensible for Carol's family. Around that time, in 1971, there was a young female police officer named Romaine Jenkins on the force. She was driven and brilliant, but was struggling to move up in the academy because it was 1971 and she was a woman. But when Carol's body was found and police realized that a young girl had been kidnapped off the streets and murdered, it became an all-hands-on-deck situation. Officer Jenkins, who had been trying to get transferred over to the homicide unit for a while, was actually assigned to work this case. She had been pushing and edging her way into homicide very slowly, using her spare time to work on cases, really having to earn it when others did. The problem was, there had never been a female police officer allowed to work on a homicide in that specific department. But because of Carol's case and the cases to come, Jenkins would go on to become the first woman assigned to the homicide unit. About 2 months later, a young girl named Darlene Denise Johnson was on her away to her summer job on July 8, 1971, but she never showed up. It had been 68 days since Carol's body was found. She was supposed to be going to the Oxen Run Recreation Center, where she was helping run an event. It was a sleepover for kids in the neighborhood, and she was a little older, kind of helping manage things at the rec center. After saying goodbye to her mother, she left for work that evening, wearing a green sweater, blue blouse, blue shorts, and a red, white, and blue striped miniskirt. Like I said, she never made it. What really stood out about this situation was that she didn't show up for work that night. It was that she lived at 3922 Wheeler Road, Southeast Washington, D.C. That's the same road that Carol Spinks had been kidnapped from 9 weeks earlier. And the two girls actually went to the same school, although they didn't personally know each other. It took a while for her disappearance to be reported because she was supposed to sleep over at the rec center for work. So her parents didn't realize she was missing until the next day. It was only after they called the rec center and learned that she had never even shown up the night before that they realized something had happened to her while she was walking to work. And she had walked the same road Carol had taken when she was abducted. As police were called in and started connecting the dots, it all began to feel eerily familiar. Carol's murder had already shaken the community to its core, and now another girl had gone missing. Another girl taken off the street. Police discovered from a witness that they believed they had seen Darlenia that night in an old black car being driven by a black male shortly after her abduction. This sighting gave them more than they had in Carol's case, but it still didn't lead anywhere. Then, just 4 days later, on July 12th, another teenager, 14-year-old Angela Denise Barnes, went missing while walking home from a Safeway store. It just seems so weird to me that all these abductions were happening so close together. And I don't mean just in terms of the area, I mean the time frame. It had only been 4 days since the previous abduction, and now another girl was gone. Even the 9 weeks between Carol and Darlenia seemed really tight. That just doesn't feel normal for a serial killer, right? Not this fast, not one after the other like this. Felt like things were spiraling quickly into a frenzy. I kept wondering, wouldn't you post up in that area? Like, if this was happening repeatedly in the same stretch of D.C., wouldn't you increase patrols, have officers watching that street, that route? You'd think so. But as I'd come to find out, the police were kind of slow in reacting while all this was happening. Just 2 days later, July 14th, 1971, Angela Barnes' body was discovered. But there were some key differences between Angela and Carol's cases. Differences that, once you know the full story, seem major. At the same time, though, Angela was only the second body found, so these details might not have stood out the way they do now. The first difference was that Angela had been shot to death. That alone was different. She was also found with her shoes on, but she lived in the same area as Carol and Darlenia. She was around the same age. She had the same physical appearance as them, so it wasn't weird that police grouped all three girls together. Then, 5 days later, on July 19, 1971, at around 5:30 p.m., and 11 days after she had gone missing, Darlenia's badly decomposed body was found by Police Sergeant Charles Baden on the grassy embankment next to the northbound lanes of Interstate 295. She was found just 15 feet away from where Carol's body had been dumped. So now we had three girls, three deaths, all dumped within roughly 11 weeks of each other. Angela's body, though, wasn't dumped on the same embankment as Carol and Darlenia's. That was one of the things that set hers apart. Like Carol, Darlenia was completely dressed, but her shoes were missing. Her body was too badly decomposed to determine a cause of death, or if she had been sexually assaulted like Carol had been. But they did find evidence of strangulation, so they assumed that she was probably strangled to death just like Carol. And if you're like me, you might be wondering, why did it take 11 days to find Darlenia if she was only 15 feet away from where Carol was found? Well, I'm about to make this whole situation and the police response sound even worse. Apparently, according to Detective Jenkins, who is still fairly low-ranking and just barely working the case at the time, there are actually two separate calls made to police on July 12th, the same day Angela had been abducted, about a possible body in the same embankment where Carol had been found. But Darlenia's body wasn't recovered until 11 days later. So yes, they were ignored. In an interview with the Washington Post, Jenkins later said that a D.C. Department of Highway and Traffic employee had car trouble on July 12, 1971, and pulled over along I-295. When he got out, he saw what he believed to be a body, possibly a mannequin, down in the ravine. He decided to call the D.C. police just in case. That same day, police received an anonymous call about a body dumped in the embankment along 295. Two calls, same day, same place. And then that day, another girl, Angela, is abducted. Police did dispatch two officers out in the embankment after receiving those calls, but they didn't even get out of the car. They just drove slowly along the side of the road and looked down in the embankment. Then they reported that they didn't see anything. 7 days after those calls, the original Department of Highway and Traffic employee who had made the first call actually drove back out to the spot on the embankment and saw that the body he had reported was still there. He was so furious that he had called the department again and demanded to speak with someone in charge. And that's when he got in touch with Sergeant Charles Baden. Baden later corroborated Officer Jenkins' claims that the police ignored those first two calls. He even remembered the second call from the highway employee clearly. The employee had once again explained exactly where the body was, on their freeway, opposite 295, just north of Bowling Air Force Base. After that call, Sergeant Baden got on his motorcycle and drove along the shoulder until he found the body. It was Darlene Yeo. Police now believe that the anonymous call from July 12th, the same day Angela was abducted, was most likely made by the killer or someone who knew what had happened. It had been too specific. But because so much time passed before that weed was acted on, it's nearly impossible to learn anything else from it now. And I was thinking, if I were somewhere and I saw a body, would I call anonymously? Or would I give my name? I think I'd be freaked out. I mean, you don't want to be suspect number one, but I feel like I'd still give my name, especially if I didn't do anything wrong. I mean, sure, I guess you could always be blamed for it, but I don't know if I'd be in the right headspace to be thinking that far ahead. And again, maybe the person who made the call had a warrant out or was on parole, someone who still wanted to help, but didn't want to risk being pulled into the investigation. Which, I mean, that makes sense. Maybe that's why they stayed anonymous. Still, the body must have been visible because Charles found it, and so did the highway worker. We also have to note here, police probably could have determined more about the crime if they had gotten to Darlene's body sooner. Like maybe on the 12th, when they were notified about it twice. The DC heat in the summertime was speeding up decomposition really badly. And I think it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. Detective Jenkins was completely right in accusing the police of dropping the ball. 8 days later, on July 27, 1971, 10-year-old Brenda Faye Crockett was abducted while walking to the Safeway grocery store. And I mean, first of all, Safeway, at this point, definitely wasn't living up to its name, apparently not very safe. And second, what is going on? Another young girl, just 5 blocks away from her home? Brenda had been sent to the store by her mother, Aretha, around 8 p.m. to grab some bread and pet food for the family dogs. Before anyone jumps to blame the mom or anything, I want to say this was completely normal behavior in this area at the time. It was the early 70s, and they didn't really know the dangers of the world the way we do now. Kids often ran errands for the parents, especially if the store was within walking distance. The Safeway Brenda was heading to was located in 1900 block of 14th Street, Northwest. She left the house barefoot, wearing pink foam curlers, and asked her mom if her friend could walk with her. But they had done plenty of times before Aretha said yes. But at the last minute, the friend wasn't able to go, so Brenda left alone. After about an hour passed and Brenda hadn't come back, her friends and family went out into the summer night to start looking for her. Then, at 9:20 p.m., the phone at the Crockett house rang. Only Brenda's 7-year-old sister was home at this time. Everyone else was still out searching for her. Her little sister answered the phone, and according to her, it was Brenda on the line. Brenda was crying. She told her sister a white man had snatched her up. She said she was somewhere in Virginia, but that she was coming home in a cab. Now keep in mind, this is a 10-year-old talking to a 7-year-old. Already, this is a very complicated, emotional, confusing conversation for two very young kids to be having. When Brenda's sister told the rest of the family about the call, they were still actively searching for her. Then, 20 minutes later, the phone rang again. This time, it was Brenda's stepfather, or her mother's boyfriend, who answered. Again, it was Brenda on the other end. She told him that she had been taken by a white man who didn't know where she was. According to police records, while she was on the phone, she asked him a very strange question. Did my mother see me? Her stepfather was confused. He asked her how her mother could have seen her. She was supposedly in Virginia right now. Brenda couldn't explain. When he asked her to put the man who took her on the phone, he heard loud, heavy footsteps in the background. And Brenda whispered, "Well, I'll see you soon," and hung up the phone. Police didn't really know what to make of those two calls. Maybe it was an attempt by the killer to distract them from what was actually happening. But Jenkins came up with her own theory. She believed that maybe the killer actually knew Brenda's mother and feared that Aretha had seen him with Brenda. So he made Brenda call home to find out. Because, I mean, why let her call home twice? What kidnapper would allow that unless there was a reason? And if that theory is true, that means the killer probably lived nearby, worked nearby, moved in those same circles. Jenkins also thought if the killer was forcing Brenda to make those calls, he might have insisted that she describe him incorrectly, because her saying a white man twice to do it to two different family members as a 10-year-old, that's just odd. Especially since it's not like her 7-year-old sister asked, "Hey, can you describe who took you?" The next morning, July 28, 1971, a hitchhiker stumbled upon Brenda's body on a grassy shoulder alongside John Hanson Highway in Chevrolet near the Baltimore-Washington Parkway in Maryland. That made four girls now. This body was found in Prince George's County, which meant that now another police unit was involved in the case. Brenda had been strangled and sexually assaulted. She was fully clothed, except, once again, for her shoes. That's now three of the four girls with missing shoes. Police also found green synthetic fibers on her clothing. Just like Carol and Darlene Yip, there was something else different. Brenda had a scarf knotted around her neck. Detective Jenkins made her way to the crime scene and noted something chilling. Brenda's feet were incredibly clean, almost like someone had washed them. Remember, she had left the house barefoot. That was the only part of her outfit that was missing, her shoes, and it looked like someone had scrubbed her feet. To me, that sounds like staging, either as a sign of remorse or to get rid of evidence. It could also tell us something about the killer's psyche. Maybe he had obsessive compulsive tendencies or fixation on cleanliness. Nearly a month went by before the next abduction. It was October 1st, 1971, when Nina Moshea Yates, also referred to in ports as Nina Moshea Yates, was taken. And once again, she was abducted while on her way to a Safeway store. I know, another Safeway. But just to clarify, this was a different Safeway. This one was located just down the street from her home. Literally, both her house and the store were on the same road. At the time, Nina's mother was in the hospital, having just delivered a baby. Her father, William Yates, a construction worker, was home that evening with Nina and her younger sibling. He needed to head back to the hospital to check on his wife and newborn, so he asked Nina to run to the store for some sugar, flour, and paper plates. She left wearing brown shorts, a sweatshirt, and white tennis shoes. When William got back from the hospital and realized Nina still wasn't home, he began calling friends and family. Then, getting more and more concerned, he walked down to the Safeway himself to look for her. He spoke with employees at the store and they confirmed that yes, she had made it there. She had purchased the items she was sent for. But when he walked back outside, he saw something devastated. All of the items she had just bought were scattered across the ground outside the store. That really stuck with me. It reminded me of Carol's case. I kept wondering what happened to her groceries. Did he take them with him? And in this case, seeing the items dumped so abruptly, this wasn't worth the time, I guess. Or maybe something had gone wrong. Just 3 hours later, her body was found on Pennsylvania Avenue. 3 hours. It felt like things were escalating. I noticed that right away while researching. In the beginning, he kept the victims alive for a while before killing them. But now he's abducting and killing them quickly. No hesitation, no delay. Excuse me. When Nina was found, her shoes were missing again. And those same green synthetic fibers were found on her clothing. I started to think that maybe whatever he was wrapping or transporting the bodies in, That material was leaving the fibers behind. It seemed like the same thing every time. Her body was still warm when the hitchhiker found her. Nearby, police found some loose change, a bag of sugar, and her house key, all scattered near her body. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled, and this time the strangulation was so violent, her esophagus had been broken. A witness came forward and said that he saw Nina getting into a blue Volkswagen with Maryland license plates. Over 25 blue Volkswagens were seized in the following investigation, but none of them led anywhere. At this point, police believe that Nina was the fourth victim in what they were starting to view as a serial abduction and murder plot. I know what you're thinking. That's the fifth girl. But the authorities had started to conclude that Angela Barnes' case wasn't connected. Their logic? Angela had been shot, not strangled. She still had her shoes on, and there were no green fibers on her body. But I didn't agree. To me, it still felt like she fit the profile. Same area, same age, same physical characteristics. Did something have gone wrong? Could she have fought back? Was the killer interrupted? She may have forced him to act differently than he usually would have. I don't know, but I wasn't ready to just discount her case from the pattern. Regardless, following Nina's death, a larger task force was formed. Detectives from Prince George's County and Maryland State Police and even the FBI joined the case. The media also began reporting more heavily on the murders. That's when the press officially dubbed the unknown killer as their freeway phantom. The name came from the way he was dumping all the bodies near roads or freeways. He looked at a map of the location and it literally formed a line following the freeway. And I kept thinking, how was this guy not caught? I know it's more complicated than it sounds, but seriously, same area, same profile, six victims, and we still didn't have a single solid lead? All of them were identified. They weren't Jane Doe's. We knew their names, we knew where they went to school, we knew their last known whereabouts, we knew the route they were walking, and we still had nothing. There was only one eyewitness account, and who knows if that even held up. Then, a month later, November 15th, 1971, another girl went missing. Brenda Denise Woodard. By this point, I was just stunned. One girl after another. So when Brenda went missing on November 15th, 1971, felt like the killer was just getting bolder, more confident, like he knew no one could stop him. Brenda had recently moved out to live on her own due to a minor disagreement with her parents. But at the time of her disappearance, they were still on good terms. They visited each other, stayed in touch. That day, her father dropped her off at Cardozo High School for her evening classes. She was studying typing and shorthand skills. After class, she went to a place called Ben's Chili Bowl with a friend to grab something to eat. Usually, her friend would have driven her home afterwards, but their car was in the shop, so they just took the city bus together. Around 11:30 p.m., they said goodbye, and Brenda waited for her connecting bus to get home. She was last seen standing at the bus stop at 8th and H Street Northeast. The next morning, at around 5 a.m., Brenda's body was found on the shoulder of the Baltimore-Washington Parkway by a Chevrolet police officer named David Norman. He had been out on routine patrol when he saw her lying there. He shone his flashlight into her eyes to check for signs of life. But she didn't blink. She didn't move. Brenda had been stabbed four times. This was the first time a victim in the Freeway Phantom series had been stabbed, and that made me pause. But she had also been sexually assaulted and strangled, which aligned with the earlier cases. It was like he still followed his pattern, but something was different this time. Brenda had defensive wounds on her hands, which she suggested that she had fought back. And honestly, that's exactly what I think happened. Brenda was older than the others, stronger, maybe more aware. I believe she fought like hell, and because of that, the killer resorted to stabbing her to gain control. But he still strangled her afterward, like that was the part he needed to do, the part he chose. Her burgundy coat was found draped over her, and her turtleneck was inside out, which made police think she had been redressed. Most of the victims had been redressed. Some of the buttons were missing from her coat and her skirt. But Brenda still had on her black boots, which was unusual because up until now, the killer had always taken her shoes. And here's where things get darker. Police found two hairs on her, one from someone of African-American descent and one from someone Caucasian. But this was 1971. There was no DNA testing, so they couldn't do much with it. But then they found a note. Yes, a handwritten note from the killer in Brenda's coat pocket. It read, "This is tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit the others when you catch me, if you can." That word tantamount was spelled incorrectly, but the meaning was crystal clear. He was saying, "These murders are equivalent to my hatred of women." I mean, this man straight up hated women, and now he was taunting the police, daring them to catch him. But here's what really gave me chills. The note was written on a piece of notebook paper torn from Brenda's school folder. The same notebook she'd been carrying with her. And even more disturbing, it looked like it had been written in her own handwriting, which meant he made her write it. I can't even wrap my head around that. He made her write her own death note, her own confession, in a way like she was his puppet. It's horrifying. At this point, the DC Metro Police Department finally created a tip line for the Freeway Phantom murders. Romaine Jenkins later admitted it was a ridiculously late reaction. The fifth murder, and only then do we open a tip line. Police held press conferences, set up roadblocks, and started releasing information about the killer and his MO to the public. Things like he strangles the victims, he dumps them on or near highways, their shoes are always missing, green synthetic fibers are always found on their clothes. While I understand why they did it, to keep the public informed and maybe get leads, it also opened the door to false confessions. Now any sicko could call in and claim responsibility just by copying the details from the news, not to mention copycat killers who could emulate the crimes just to confuse police or get attention. Between November and December 1971, a psychologist named Dr. Sheldon Freud worked with police and pointed out something eerie. Three of the five victims so far had the middle name Denise. At first, I hadn't even caught that, but looking back, Carol Denise Spinks, Darlenia Denise Johnson, Brenda Denise Woodard, that was chilling. Police issued a public warning specifically to young black girls with a middle name Denise. They were like, be alert, take precautions. Can you imagine hearing that your middle name might be putting you at risk? They also asked the public for any young girls who had experienced recent close calls to come forward. Like if someone tried to lure them, offered them a ride, or anything suspicious. Even if it didn't seem serious, they wanted to know. Within 4 days, the tip line received 4,000 calls. Mostly from women reporting strange men, suspicious vehicles, being harassed or followed. And honestly, that's just a daily reality for women. That number alone shows what we deal, or I should say, what they deal with constantly. Some theories started to emerge after the tip line was flooded with thousands of calls. One idea was that the person committing these murders might be a school teacher or someone who worked in education. Why? Because how else would they have known the girls' middle names, especially if they weren't being published in the news? He seemed very, very close to everyone in the area. Too close. He knew things he shouldn't have. That led people to believe he either lived, worked, or moved regularly through the same neighborhoods these girls came from. The public was now on high alert. At one point, a group of over 200 Vietnam War veterans formed something called the Veterans Protective League. They started patrolling the highways in their own cars, 24 hours a day. Can you imagine? Veterans home from a brutal war, taking it upon themselves to protect their community when the police couldn't or wouldn't. That tells you just how afraid people were. And then 10 months passed. Nothing. No bodies, no new abductions, no signs of the phantom. So police and the public started to think that the killer had either left the area or been arrested for something else. Maybe he was sitting in prison on unrelated charges. But then everything changed again. On September 5th, 1972, the final known victim of the Freeway Phantom was found. Her name was Diane Denise Williams. She was 17 years old. She was 17 years old, a senior at Ballou High School. That evening, she had cooked dinner for her family and gone to visit her boyfriend. After spending time with him, he drove her to the bus stop on Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue so she could head home. Later that night, her mother, Margaret, noticed Diane hadn't come home by her curfew. She told her husband, Leon, and called the boyfriend. He confirmed that, yes, he had seen Diane board the bus over an hour ago. The bus driver remembered her, too. He said she got off at Martin Luther King Avenue and South Capitol Street. From there, it should have been a short walk home. But Diane never came home. The next morning, Leon called the police to report his daughter missing. On his way home from working the night shift, he passed a truck pulled off on the side of the road with a small group of people standing around it. But he was focused, worrying about Diane, so he just kept driving. What he didn't know was that the truck had stopped because the driver had noticed something strange on a grassy incline next to the highway. It was Diane's body. She had been strangled, and her body was found along I-295, about 200 yards from the DC line. Again, her shoes were missing. But this time, there were no signs of sexual assault, which felt different from the previous victims. Her parents were called in to identify her body, but the rest of the family found out from the news broadcast. Not the police. Finally, in 1974, the FBI created a task force to investigate the Freeway Phantom murders. At its peak, the task force had over 100 detectives and agents from the DC Metro Police, Prince George's County, and the Maryland State Police working the case. People were hoping this would finally be the break. And then someone came forward. An inmate offered information about another fellow inmate claiming he had confessed to the murders. But when police looked into it, they found that the man behind being accused actually had an airtight alibi. And here is something I learned in my research that I found pretty disturbing. Over the years, jailhouse informants have been responsible for some of the most frequent wrongful convictions in U.S. criminal history. Millions of dollars have been wasted chasing false leads from prisoners who either wanted favors or attention. And yet, this tactic is still used today. Eventually, also in 1974, two former D.C. police officers, Edward Sullivan and Tommy Simmons, were arrested and charged with the murder of Angela Denise Barnes. Yes, the same Angela the police said wasn't connected to the Freeway Phantom murders. Turns out, you know how I was skeptical about her case being separate? Turns out I was probably right. These two cops were the ones who had shot her. But the authorities claimed that Angela's murder was not linked to the other cases. They said Sullivan and Simmons only killed her, and that it wasn't related to the serial killer. I don't know if I fully buy that. I mean, how convenient, right? One case, the only one with a gunshot wound, and it's the only one attributed to different killers. Maybe they weren't involved in the other cases, sure, but to me, it's just a little strange. Then in March 1977, a new name entered the investigations. Robert Elwood Askins. He was a 58-year-old computer technician and was arrested and charged with abducting and raping a 24-year-old woman inside his Washington, D.C. home. But when police arrested him and started digging into his past, what they found was beyond disturbing. This man had a history of murder charges. He had been poisoning, assaulting, abducting, and killing women all across Washington, D.C. He didn't just dislike women, he seemed to despise them. And he made that very clear. Eventually, Askins was found criminally insane and committed to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, the same hospital that sat right across the street from where the first two girls had been dumped. I mean, come on, that can't be a coincidence, right? Many people, even years later, strongly believe that Robert Askins was the Freeway Phantom. He fit the profile in a terrifying way. But even though police searched his home, even though he had a long history of violence against women, and even though an eyewitness picked him out of the lineup, there was no physical evidence. No fibers, no DNA, no clear-cut proof linking him to the Freeway Phantom murders. And so, nothing came of it. He was never charged, he denied everything related to the Phantom, and he died in 2010, maintaining that he had no role in any of those murders. Still, there were clues that he might have been involved. One of the most compelling things, the note found in Brenda Woodard's coat pocket, the one written in her own handwriting. Askins was well-educated, and he liked to use unusual vocabulary. That word tantamount from the note, it's not exactly common, especially not in 1971, and it fits with the kind of language Askins was known to use. But again, it wasn't enough. A woman named Victoria Hester and her father Blaine Pardo ended up spending years researching the case. He even wrote a book called Tantamount, The Pursuit of the Freeway Phantom Serial Killer. Their theory, someone out there knows who did this. Because the killer kept trophies. He took school books, curlers, shoelaces, personal items from the girls. They believe those items are still out there. Maybe in someone's attic, a garage, a log trunk in a basement. Somewhere those objects might still exist, and someone might recognize them if they knew what to look for. They also believe the St. Elizabeth's Psychiatric Hospital plays a major role in this case, not just because Askins was a patient there, but because of the location, the access, and the eerie... They also believe that the St. Elizabeth's Psychiatric Hospital plays a major role in this case, not just because Askins was a patient there, but because of the location, the access, and the eerie connections. I did some of my own digging after learning this, and I found out that St. Elizabeth has thousands of former patients buried in unmarked graves across its property. No headstones, no names, just plots of land full of people who were forgotten. The hospital had poor record keeping, and to this day, the full number and exact locations of those graves are unknown. To make things even more unsettling, the hospital also had an on-site incinerator at the time. The book also points to another possible victim named Tara Bryant, who isn't listed in the official Freeway Phantom files. Tara was found on November 26, 1972, under a bridge in the DC metro area. She had been strangled, her body was washed, and yes, she was missing a shoe. But police never connected her case to the others, possibly because her body wasn't found near a freeway, but instead under a bridge. Still, with that many similarities, I think it's a stretch to leave her out. That's what makes this case so hard to unravel. Even with 7 confirmed victims, maybe more, so much remains unknown. So many theories, suspects, so many leads that went cold. And over time, evidence was lost, moved, or destroyed. Officers retired or passed away. And most tragically, the momentum faded. I honestly believe there's a very good chance the killer is dead by now. If he was in his 40s or 50s back then, he'd be over 90 now, if he's even alive. If he was in his 30s, maybe he lived into the 2000s. Either way, we'll probably never hear him confess. What gets to me is that we don't even have DNA, at least not any that's been made public. Even if the killer was still alive today, it doesn't sound like we'd be able to match anything to him. And even if he's gone, that doesn't help the families that are still here, still wondering, still afraid. I just can't believe someone got away with this. 6, possibly more, young girls abducted, murdered, and left like trash on the side of the road. All of them lived in the same general area, went to the same schools, walked the same streets, and still, no one saw anything. No one was caught. I don't know if it was Askins. I don't think it was the 2 cops, at least not for all the girls. Maybe Angela Barnes was an isolated case. Maybe the others weren't. But I still think about the missed calls, the ignored tips, the clues that weren't followed. And I wonder, how close did we get? Did someone actually talk to him? Was his name on a list somewhere, and we just didn't realize it? This case is one of the most devastating examples of what happens when a system fails to protect the most vulnerable and when entire communities are ignored. The sisters, the families, they're still alive, still carrying this, and I just wish they could have some peace. I don't know if closure is the right word, but I wish they could have some justice. Even if it's too late for prosecution, just to know. To know who he was, to know why. But, tragically, they probably never will. Let me know your thoughts on this case in the comments section below. Let me know your theories on who you think is the Freeway Phantom Killer. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. And of course, you can find us on all major podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, anywhere you get your podcast from, we'll be there. Of course, thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time.
Location, the lab. Quentin only has 24 hours to sell his car. Is that even possible? He goes to Carvana.com.
What is this, a movie trailer?
He ignores the doubters, enters his license plate. Wow, that's a great offer. The car is sold, but will Carvana pick it up in time for...
They'll literally pick it up tomorrow morning. Done with the dramatics?
Car selling in record time.
Save your time. Go to Carvana.com and sell your car today. Pickup fees may apply.